This is Terry Gibson, Cinema and Spirituality, October 26, 1991, tape 1 and 2 of 3.
Marina, or acrobat, Antipeter Falk. And what we find out is that Falk was apparently a previous angel. As the film develops, Falk's a previous angel. And he feels this guy around and he says, "You can just step across, you'll like it." That kind of Columbo style. You like, still got the trench coat, you like it. And the thing is, he says, "My God," he says, "when I came across, the first thing I got," he says, "you can't imagine what a cup of hot coffee feels like on a cold November morning. How it feels and how it tastes. And touching another's warm skin. And hearing a baby cry and knowing you can touch the baby." I mean, it's this poignant stuff. "I know you're there, brother. Come across anytime you want to." And the film's about how this angel finds a way to come across. And finds a touching, I won't tell you how, but a touching conjunctio with the circus acrobat. This one scene, I just want you to see, you get a flavor of this really extraordinary film. It's an ordinary scene where you get a feeling of how these angels hover and hear the sorrow and the pain of this divided world. And then they get together for kind of an angel staff consultation. And they meet in a new, as a good angel, they got taste, they meet in the leather-covered seats of a Mercedes or something in a car dealership to share angel observations of the day. And it's a very touching kind of scene.
Could you comment on one thing about that movie? I've seen it twice. The one scene where the narrative, Peter Falk is narrating, he's looking around and he's seeing the extras, and he talks about extra. And I was wondering if your comment on that was, I have an idea, but I...
Well, I'd be interested in your idea. I mean, I don't have an immediate idea about that.
That was the idea that the extra people in the world are just there as filler, like the Shakespearean idea of we have all these principal actors and actresses and everybody else is just kind of here.
It's an interesting notion.
Not real, you know. Like that.
And for these angels, everybody's real. They have a hovering presence for everything, human pain and sorrow, wherever it is. I don't know, it's an interesting observation. And I hope, it's here. As painful as this world is, and as hard as it is for us to feel our redemptive sorrow, when we get conscious to it, we still are more than just spirit. We got a body and can feel our bare feet under a table and can lie through our teeth and be savage and be alive, be aware of evil and good, have a good meal. It's a real wonderful film. You'll get a chance to see it. I think it's really a film about the real goal of individuation, the Gnostics' goal. The Gnostics got hung up in their way in our tradition. The Christians got hung up, and the Hindus and the Buddhists, we all get hung up. The central problem is how to put spirit and body and keep them together in a healthy and whole and loving sense. The goal of individuation is to bring those together. Wings of desire, vim vinder. I'm going to close it. So I said one extended bibliography, and people have been asking me, and I have a few other, I have another book list, and then just a few closing questions. People have got them. And I hope I put the list on top someplace close. Aha. These are primarily clinical books on cinema and film. Some people had asked me about it. There's, again, not much literature there, not just Jungian, but clinically, but some books that I found interesting recently. Glenn Gebhard, not two G's, not two Gebhards, not Glenn Gebhard. That's just I'm psychically dyslexic, just repeating myself. Cinema and Psychiatry, really nice look. And he's one of the first people to kind of imagine things like The Potential and Alien. He looks at several films and likes Woody Allen. The first part of the book I found kind of boring. He talks about images of psychiatry and cinema over the last 50 years, as though that's something I really want to know much about. But the last part is about how psychoanalytic images get used on the screen. Talks about the new Lacanian school, and very clear and easy to read looks at some popular favorite films. Woody Allen's Stardust Memories, he looks at Alien, he looks at several in a very interesting way.
Ann Kaplan, Psychoanalysis and Cinema, brand new book, takes a look at the feminists particularly that are reviving this Lacanian interest. Christian Metz, difficult but good book. He's just getting translated. This stuff really was done in the early to mid-70s, but the lag in getting it from French into English. Psychoanalysis and Cinema, The Imaginary Signifier, a dense, but if you stay with it, I found his prose to be quite exciting to look at this really tough issue about Lacanian views of early pre-incestuous existence, cinema, and our role as the spectator and voyeur, and the transformative possibilities of understanding film. It's a great book, but it's difficult, and it's theoretical, and it's dense, but he writes well. Right? It's all of those things. And Constance Penley is a woman I've enjoyed the most, a feminist, an American feminist scholar. She comes from literature, but writes wonderfully about film, feminism, and psychoanalysis, and I find her stuff to be very provocative, and again, a fairly recent book. But those four I found to be real useful. All of them, Gebhard's the most easy reading, accessibly. The others take some energy. You don't read them late at night when you're tired. They won't be worth your effort. Anything? We've been kind of dialoguing during the day as we go, but any kind of debriefing, questions, reactions? Well, last 5 or 10 minutes?
I just have a comment. Thursday night, there was a thing on television with a retrospective of women in media and television.
No.
But I was really surprised by what it pointed out about how culture is reflected through television. And what you were saying last night about how 4,000 years from now films are going to be a reference on culture. I think TV will.
Well, certainly.
Look at it as that.
Certainly. I haven't watched the show in 15 years, but I found myself coming home to Carson's last show when he had the retrospective of 30 years of him. I watched, and so much of my psychic experience tied to being in rooms where that image was around. I might have been doing homework as an adolescent, or those images have been around our lives. They've been playing from images. You visit people's homes, and Johnny Carson was there 11 o'clock at night. I mean, these are archetypal figures. And I think you're right.
The novel Exposure that you showed at Sound last spring, Sound Off is a great thing.
The TV series?
Yeah, the first two episodes fall. It's quite old. Hopefully.
Get there. Looks like within you're all looking tired. You're tired looking at a lot of a lot of stuff coming in. It's like it's like visual overload after a while. This is so provocative and so much.
Do you teach anywhere?
This material I do teach in a variety of places on a lot of different stuff. But this particular thing, this is only the second time. Kate caught the first time. I did it for this thing called Community down in Tacoma, which is a collaboration between their church council and University of Puget Sound and Pacific Lutheran University. And they've asked me to do it again with a second seminar, and I'm going to be doing it in the spring. It's all 4 Sundays in February. And I think it's on the campus of the University of Puget Sound this year. You can either call me and leave your phone number and address, and I can get Associated Ministries to you, or you can just call Associated Ministries direct in Tacoma, and they'll mail you a copy of their community brochure. They have a mass mailing that thing. It usually comes out December and January. It's actually interesting that there's that, but they get 30. If you're interested in kind of spirituality and culture issues, it's a very provocative. They get 20 to 30, really. They get a major plenary speaker and then 20 to 30 local professors and faculty to talk about a variety of different things. It's everything from liberation theology to this new theology of chaos, to look at Native American spirituality. And I mean, it's a real interesting, eclectic gamut of kind of relevant psycho-spiritual issues in the culture. And I've been kind of the in-house Jungian for, I've done it every year for 12 years. And I like it because it's, people are real eager, and it's a great place to break into it. And I've wanted to do this for a long time, but I wasn't at all sure how it would go and how I would do it. I mean, it's just so much. And I just finally wanted to do something different last spring and did it and had a good time. And so I said, I think I'll consider doing it again this year, so I'll run it in February.
And you should note that Terry's going to be the commentator and see The Way of the Dream. It's a 20 half-hour movie. videos of Maria Lilly, Von Franz, and Green work, and that'll be the end of February.
Last Saturday in February and first Sunday in March.
At the University of Washington, they're co-sponsored with the University of Extension and the Fairview of Kubernetes.
And he will also be presenting for us on a Monday evening after Christmas. That's what about
it. Yeah, I don't remember either. But
it's either in January, February, or March. I'm going to be
dull. That's a kind of analyst seminar on basic Jung concepts.
Fundamentals.
Different analysts are going to present different things around the idea of meaning, search for meaning.
And I want to thank you all. You've been really present. It was nice. The group felt just the right size today to have some kind of interaction around this stuff. I really appreciated your all's presence, and it's been kind of fun. And your all's feedback. It's what's fun about this is I get different ideas every time you see it. I mean, there's no right way to look at this material. It's really complex and important. This was kind of fun just sitting in the dark with you for 7 hours today.
Thank you.
Different stages and categories, but it's a four-part model. And one of the things that a man needs to learn, you start at the bottom here, is, and most men never get this figured out, is how to become a lover instead of an Oedipal child. And what has to be resolved, if you're going to stop being mama's boy or a dreamer, that's the those are the two the pathological possibilities here if you don't work this out. How do you stop being a mama's boy and a dreamer? What do you have to do? It's been a theme I've been talking about for the last 2 days. What's a man got to do if he's going to stop being a mama's boy or a puerish dreamer? Who's he have to give up? He's got to give up mom. He's got to really break the incest bond, or he's not going to make it. He's just not going to individuate. And then he becomes a lover. You know, some men give up mom enough to get out in the outer world, but you got men misfire there. They haven't individuated. They may get to the abyss, and they may even know they got to jump, and then they jump, and they get terrified. So they have multiple addictive relationships, or they become impotent. Show that a lot in therapy. And you know, there's no secret that among the professions now, male professionals are out of control, violating women patients. I mean, it's an addiction, and men have multiple sexual relationships, homosexual, heterosexual. This thing about sex being an anxious. One of the addictive things that we don't talk enough about is that we not only have troubles in this culture with chemicals and food and with alcohol, but there's a terrible sex addiction problem running. I went to a meeting in the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. It is the premier, it's the flagship group, certifying group for family therapists in this country. They're the keepers of this wonderful new systems model. And they have a huge convention. I mean, they're the second largest mental health group. Now, I think APA's got 130,000, 140,000. AMFT now is getting up to 70,000, 80,000. They have a huge convention. In San Francisco, there must have been 5,000, 6,000 people came, even though we were there a week after the earthquake. People came. Packed that thing. They had a giant AA meeting at night. And on some nights, a larger group was the sex addicted group. Professional therapists had learned that they were sexually addicted and actually came to these conventions and were living out their addictions at the conventions. And there was a self-awareness that was addictive, and they needed some kind of group to kind of deal with the impulses when they got out of the containers of their marriage and their practice in their home. This deep anxiety about acting out sexually. Boy and girl psychology is going on there. It happens all over. And we now know it's primarily men. Most of the cases of sexual abuse are in a very few women with male patients. Or women with women. It's males, overwhelming number of men. And most of them are predators. The MO on these men are very interesting. Predators, multiple addictions. You get with a lot of these men. I've been on review committees sometimes. They'll tell you 90, 80, 90, 100 women that they can remember, that they can tell you about. I mean, it's a predatory, compulsive, and most of them were men that were badly incested in their family of origin. I mean, they kind of follow the abuse MO. And I don't know how much therapy can even access. I'm pretty sober now about what you can do with that except live with the pain in a more conscious way. And I'm also real sober. I don't know that analysis. I think analysis does a lot of good things. I've been concerned about whether the Jungian models we practice at now much really cracks the addictive. I don't know any therapy really can say they feel real confident about it. And at this AMFT meeting, the news had just breached there. Of course, Bill W., one of the things that had just come out was that apparently Bill W., one of the founders of AA, stopped drinking, but he became a sex addict the last 20, 30 years of his life. So even the AA movement now is feeling some kind of dismay about addiction. And we're all addicted to something. When I look at my own behaviors, addicted to behaviors or caffeine or sugar, or we're all addicted to ways to assuage our fear of developing and individuating. And I need to be frank, I'm not sure that Jungian analysis works any better or has any better wrench on that nut than anybody else. I don't feel real confident about what the model can do with it. It's a hard, deep, mysterious phenomenon of our time and culture. But clearly, Moore and Gillette are saying if men are going to individuate, they got to deal with it this level.
I had my own experience in my own analysis. Early on, I had a counselor therapist who had me read out of the shadows and had me put into that category of affection, which, as a good boy, I bought it. And I ran around with the flag waving, and I enjoyed it for a while. And what I found out later that I went to a different analyst to become frightened in my life. I had a change analyst. And I went down the whole list of the gamut, you know, what my addiction and so forth were, and she went down with me. She said, what I don't see is sexual addiction. She said, what I see is inability to have an intimate relationship with a partner. And I went, oh, okay. Now it was out of the bag. I can wave that other flag, and I see a lot of this going on with something.
I think intimacy...
It's fun to be a sex addict.
Yeah.
It literally is.
And, of course, I think what that says is, I think it's true, is that probably we get in addictive behaviors because that unresolved incest regress wound is there, and it panics us. We don't want to see it, so it's easier to act out our anxiety in an addictive kind of way than work through our pain and stay on that abyss and jump and keep falling. It's frightening.
That's my question that you touched on last night, and I don't know if I really got it, and I wanted you to say something about it. You said that the incest, you know, the feelings are always there. And I guess it's what you do with them that really matters. But that they're there, and what is it? That you just, you conscious, I don't know how you deal with them in a healthy way. You know what I'm saying?
No.
You were talking about dealing with them in a healthy way so people can go on and individuate. And I don't understand that. Healthy way.
You kind of touch on it's getting conscious that that's what's going on.
And it's always going on.
It's always going on. Whenever we feel hyperly anxious about something, or we have a major symptom in our life, or a complex that comes up over and over, we have trouble with work and we can't seem to succeed at something, or our relationships keep failing at the same point, or we develop an anxiety about something, my sense is almost invariably traces back to having not finished the separation from my mothers and fathers and owned the grief of that and our own adult autonomy and get moving with it. It's always related to that at some level. And so analysis helps people face that. And I think some people just do it naturally in life. If you ask, you want me to give an example where that shows up in a clinical vignette? Oh, something just occurs to me if you wanted to hear a little bit of a recent clinical case about, we're talking about men's stuff, and this might be relevant. Let me finish the model. Now, I'll tell you the case, and I'll let you ask me, or I'll have you all tell me where you think this is an 18-year-old boy, what he's working with out of this model. I'll tell you the story about how it shows up for him. Next thing, you talk about the precocious child. A lot of men get into, you see a lot of these, I mean, most of the men that I see in industry and come in for therapy are arrested, that you got to be a precocious child, that you got to be the bright young man on the way up in a lot of these companies and in the professions. They know it all. The fear, this can split, and either you get the know-it-all or the dummy. And men will get defensive and misfire in one of two directions. They either hyper-function or under-function. A lot of men that come in midlife crisis, that come in analysis, they're still in that kind of boy psychology world. Man psychology is the magician. And if people don't play it just right, there's a danger of becoming the detached manipulator or the denying innocent one. And I think a lot of famous therapists in the pop psych circuit, I think Jung when he was a young man, Milton Erickson I mentioned last night when he was a young man, when you hear about these therapists in the first half of their life, they had reputations of being the magician, and I think they often abused it by becoming detached manipulators. They knew how to do, and push buttons and be famous and know it all. It was kind of a, they were both boy, had problems of boy and man psychology, and they would manipulate people for their own narcissistic self and aggrandizement. And we see that all the time. The most poignant, easy, take a cheap shot example now is Jimmy Swaggart. I mean, that would be a classic example of the magician manipulator. And he gets caught with his, literally with his pants down twice within 2 years. I mean, it's even mental. I've also been interested that a lot of males that are caught and not individuated and are manipulators and are addicted and all that shadow stuff, around menopause, you know, if you read the classic literature about puers, these bright young, and puellas, the bright young men and women that are afraid to age and individuate, aging is like death to them, and a lot of these men that I've seen, colleagues of misfires, like between age 48 and 52, kind of male menopause, that stuff breaks down, they don't have the energy to keep it going all the time, the denial breaks down, and they almost collude in their own exposure. It's been really kind of, they collude in their own self-destruction. It's interesting to me, and it's sad.
Driving the car crazy.
Yeah. Trying to put pornography on the seat here with the prostitute sitting next to me. I mean, the story reads like, you know, what well put together dissembling evangelist would ever get caught in that kind of deal? I mean, you have to be colluding with your own destruction to get caught. Notice me.
I just thought
Pee Wee Herman. Well, yeah, also same addictive kind of dilemma. Then you get the hero, the boy that wants to be the grandstander, bully, or the coward. That's the way it splits. But you can't play that right in the middle. Now, a perfect film example of that. Remember The Black Stallion? That's a great example of playing it right down the middle. There's a wonderful latency age story about getting rid of dad and having incest with mom. Remember that thing? He's on a boat. He's with dad, and it's off to North Africa. You never even know if this is a dream. It has a surreal quality. His dad's a famous gambler, a little tricky, but a nice man. The ship goes down. The only thing that's saved is he and this black stallion are washed ashore in the desert, and he learns to befriend the horse and get this power between his legs and ride it bareback. And he and the horse go back, and mommy's sad, and he's back with mother, and he meets Mickey Rooney and this mysterious black man, and they teach him how to be a jockey and learn how to ride the horse, and he goes to this famous horse race and wins it at the end. And who is up in the stands for this 8 or 9 year old boy who's just thrilled to the center of her being but mama? I mean, it is every latency age boy's dream of the hero come home. But he's neither a grandstand bully or a coward in that thing. And that film is talking about how to individuate with that energy. Just, it's an interesting film, how to be just right with it. Then if men can get past the hero stuff, get into the warrior. I mean, really a warrior. That's what those Persian Gulf men wanted to be in Boys and Men. And I went, my family visited, and I've got a wonderful 3-year-old niece and a 2-year-old nephew, and just love to do fun things. We took them to the Seafair Parade. I'd never gone to that. But I didn't realize there were going to be all the marching soldiers going by. I mean, it was lots of Mickey Mouse and stuff, and he's wonderful. And then the soldiers. It was an interesting thing. Disney and soldiers in Wave. I don't know if any of you saw it last summer. It's a strange. But what I saw was these men wanted what they wanted to be, and what was stirred in all of us. I felt even a little of the passion, even though I had the horror about the war. We want to believe there are just warriors in the world. There are warriors that fight for truth. And they really are just. I mean, we want to believe that these crisp uniformed people are the soldiers of the light. I mean, we want to believe. We all want the warrior in our men and in ourselves. We want that. It's not a bad quality. Irwin Bly is trying to say, that kind of strength is not a bad quality. Not very found very often. Not a bad quality. But most of the time, it either becomes a sadist or a masochist. The warrior energy pollutes, and men can't individuate through the middle and stay whole. Then you have the divine child. The high chair tyrant throws his food all around and demands to be the center of thing, or the weakling prince, the kind of sickly, whiny, colicky baby boy. And then you've got the king. And all the great mythic sagas, the most famous saga that's still alive, men that are in therapy with me dream about it incessantly. I don't find women dreaming about it as much. But probably this, I don't know if Kate and Gordon, Carl, you're all, others are clinicians, your experience has been this, but the most recurrent theme I see in males' dreams, the corpus, is the Grail corpus. Metaphors and allusions to that show up over and over, and it's still the living myth, I think, for male psychology. And the whole central theme about that, you know, whether it's Gawain or Parsifal who actually find the Grail castle again. My favorite story is it's Parsifal, the fool knight, the vulnerable knight, the innocent mother's boy knight that has to finally cut the incest with his mother and go out and be a famous knight. But you know, the whole story is about this aging king, the consciousness of the old king. The male king is outworn. He's got probably a syphilic wound. So in the early text, that's really the clear allusion. It's a sexual wound. And you sense probably it's a wound because he violated something. You know, he used his eros in an inappropriate way. He's got an upper leg wound that's bleeding. And, you know, Parsifal stumbles in. He goes twice. He stumbles in the first time, doesn't know where he is. And he sees all of these Vestal virgins carrying all of these sacred things. And then he sees the levitating cup go by. And if you know the story, he then sees the old king is brought out, and he's just bleeding and pale. And because he's still a mama's boy, and he's not individuated, to using this model, he'd been told that a chivalric knight never looks at ugly things or comments about it. That's bad. Ms. Manners or Lord Manners told him not to do that. What you needed to do, though, was to stare at the wound of the father with compassion, and to be able to look at the old consciousness with compassion and forgiveness, and say, "What ails thee, my king?" And in that moment, the Grail cup becomes available, and the verdancy and greenness and moisture returns to Camelot.
I just wanted to mention something, because there is a film, I don't know if you've seen it, I saw it in Europe, of the Wagner opera of Parsifal. Mm-hmm. It's 5.5 hours long. And I saw it in movie theaters. If you ever have any interest, I didn't know if it was either was.
No.
I don't know who made it, and I don't know where it is.
I'd love to see it.
It's just fabulous. I thought.
I'd like to add it. I kind of use filmography with some patients. It's sometimes a way to kind of, if they're in the material, to continue to amplify it. Closest one that I've liked in recent years is the Excalibur, the Orion Productions film called Excalibur. It has a real, Richard Harris plays the kind of trickster, bumbling Merlin in that thing. It's a wonderful, but I think to use this therapeutically, I think film's a great resource potentially for some clients. The king could become either a tyrant or a weakling. And, of course, this George Bush Saddam Hussein stuff, you saw their fears of being the weakling. Anyone wanted to be a wimp. And there was a push in both, and that neither side recognized the projections of the tyrant, you know, the kind of controlling, absolute, all-seeing, all-prescient tyrant. And, of course, all our projections are Saddam Hussein carries all the craziness. We all know he's crazy. But, you know, it's real hard for us to get in on the other side and then look how crazy it may look coming the other way and how much reaction formation there might be in George Bush against his old wimpiness receiving that. And the dreamer, the dummy, the coward, the weakling prince, weakling masochist, denying innocent one, an impotent lover that lives in George Bush, that he can't, it's all split off from him. He does not want to look. Men cannot look at this. Only individuated men will look at that. And that's a process. So, two models. I just want to put this, two analytic models about masculinity. Now let's just look at some film. We'll see what film says. See if any of this works. See if this works. I'll show a couple. I don't want to run through all these images. I'm going to show you first a situation that's not working well. A couple that's having a little trouble. I've been writing an article about 8 months now about Jungian analysis in marriage and family therapy, and I have a whole section on incest I've been talking about. Murray Bowen and Framo, a lot of work the family therapists are doing with it, and Jung's work with it. The second part, I'm talking about couples, and I'm using the Rosarium images again. You know, that psychology transference essay. Jung was real fascinated with this 15th century alchemical text, the Rosary of the Philosophers. And the Rosary of the Philosophers, the Rosarium Philosophorum. And got a recent, it's kind of hard to get, but an English translated text, and it had some of the original woodcuts. I wanted to look at them. And I've got the images with me, and I don't want to take them all, but there's two sequences in the full Rosarium when you look at, as you all know, there's a, give you the structure. Nathan Schwartz for your group gave a nice talk a couple years ago about this, but you know that it's backwards. But the Rosarium, the first image is this fountain. And you can see the masculine, the feminine, solemn mood. I don't want to go. These are complex images, as all these alchemical. But, you know, it's the mercurial fountain and the healing of the aquas permanens, the water of the soul, the deep psyche, that self that needs to water the arid ego, and that model we've been using today. But I just want you to get a sense of these images. You know, it starts, this is the couple, and what I'm thinking about is I'm beginning to wonder if the writer of this had to be married. Could not be a single person. This person knew about how this suffering goes on inside, but I think this person knew about the projections in a real outer world relationship. This looks like a couple standing at the altar. You know, that day when we really believe that all of the external vows we're sharing with each other and any kind of love relationship we are really the truth. We're really, you know, we have all this incest and unconscious agenda that we never own. And that stuff's hidden off. It becomes apparent usually, it became apparent to me 8 hours after I was married. Rosabeth and I figure out a way to have a fight to avoid having, our first kind of consummation experience. And I was out looking for flu medication at 2 o'clock in the morning in downtown Kansas City, wondering, what does this happen? Why has this happened? You know what? And I was unconscious. I didn't realize that we'd colluded to have an event and to express our anxiety about suddenly discovering the truth about each other and what we'd really vowed to and what a difficult thing this is going to be, what a terrifying thing this is going to be. This couple doesn't know how terrified it is yet. Dove with the spirits coming down, they're fully clothed, they're standing in their masculinity and femininity. And then they get naked. Things get naked pretty quick. Within 8 hours on my wedding night, I started noticing there's some naked qualities to this I don't like at all. You know, and they are much more complex than this, but my wife and I also found like we were in the soup together. Oh, there's this kind of giant hot tub, this psychic alchemical vat, and we're cooking up the stuff of the unconscious. And, you know, you've seen these images. It knocks us flat, knocks our socks off and knocks us flat. We try to co-yune. But we're also, coitus is kind of a funny death. And this thing starts looking more like a tomb all the time. Look at these images. We start getting into our unisexness and our fear. And there's death. There's some death imagery here. And this little pooty comes. See these, the renewing cloud above? The dew of the unconscious gets pushed away. This is how the images go. I don't want to go through the whole series. But it does this twice. There are two sets of images. They call one set kind of a red stage. It's kind of a, I think, dealing with the death that happens when we vow and get in relationship with our unconscious, and I think with a real outer other. It has to do with the death that we get into when we really engage our depth unconscious and we engage somebody else. The death, the surrender to loss and death when that man in the abyss today stepped off, and you really realize when you've married something inside yourself and you're individuating with it, or you're married or joined or vowed with a real outer world man or woman and you've jumped into that abyss, you become aware that that vow is really a willingness to consciously die. Things have to die for life. And the whole first stage of these things are about the death of ego, I think, personally and relationally and spiritually. It's got to die. Has to die. Adolf Guggenbuehl Craig, if you've not read, it's got a very few Jungian books have about marriage, but Marriage, Dead or Alive, and he uses a lot of Greek, the problems in the Greek households, the marriages of the Greek gods. It's a nice metaphor for the troubles in our own households. But Guggenbuehl Craig says the truth. He doesn't say this directly, but he says marriage is really, it's not for happiness, for suffering, what I was talking about last night. Any kind of deep love relationship is for suffering and not happiness. And we have to become, he uses the word, soteriological questers and warriors. It is is the most difficult form of spiritual direction. And if you read Guggenbuehl Craig, the state of Washington, on a print on the bottom of the license, warning, the Surgeon General says that this may be dangerous to your health and well-being to enter this. This is one of the most dangerous, and probably the best, but one of the most dangerous ways to gain consciousness and psyche. Enter this at your own risk. Most marriages, outer world marriages, and love relationships in this culture get trapped in the death and never get out. Now, the second set of images, the albedo, the whitening, the spiritualizing stage, is the puti. They go through the whole sequence again, and what it produces at the end is the conjunctio, the hermaphrodite, the male, and the risen Christos that's both a man and a woman. And he has both of those qualities resurrected out of the unconscious. The alchemist's desire was not to create real gold, but the gold of the Christos, the spirit, the imago Dei, the deep self, the realization of compassionate, sorrowful soul in our lives and in our relationships. Okay, show two vignettes. The first one we're all familiar with, but it was horrifying. I mean, people, Danny DeVito couldn't do something this weird, everybody thought. I mean, people thought they were tricked when they went to War of the Roses. They said, this is weird. This is not Danny. This is not Funny Taxi Man. This is weird, and it's also unsettling. It was a very raw, not since Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor played out Edward Albee, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, 20 years earlier, had people seen the brutality of the death of marriage and relationship in this culture and the pain and anguish we're all in, and told the truth about it. George and Martha told all of our truth. It was almost unbearable. We could not look at it. Well, War of the Roses was the same way. Remember, it starts, great narrative film with that kind of opening romantic scene of a couple meeting in Nantucket, young couple. Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas. What nicer couple could you find anywhere? Huh?
They're all been
romancing the stone. I mean, you know, sure. I mean, this is the ideal couple. Danny DeVito was a dummy trickster, but he was a fun trickster in them. Egypt and Guatemala and all of them. It was great, great kind of grocery store gothic romance novels. It was wonderful. And this is the couple, and they meet in a rainstorm. And I love Nantucket Island. Very romantic notions. A rainstorm in Nantucket Island. Interested in antiques. An old car. And they marry. And immediately, patriarchy, which has inflicted wounds equally on both men and women, take over. He goes off to the office. All she's left is with the kids and bigger homes she can buy with his money. And a growing sense of relational despair and the empty projective world that they live in. And it gets more and more savagely pulled apart, and they finally can't. And as I think often happens, and again, men feel judged by this, I think men have been equally wounded. The feminist critique does not judge. But women, I think, are more quick to be aware of the pain of what the agony we're all suffering is, and to tell the truth about it earlier. And Kathleen Turner tells the truth first about, I can't stand this pain anymore. He's denied. You know, he has a heart attack, and she hopes he's died. She tells him that. You know, that ends in the... Remember that? As I've seen, he has these anxiety symptoms. He knows that something in his heart is wrong. And she gets to the hospital late, and he says, well, I know, honey. I know you were scared. She says, no, you don't get it. She says, I know, honey. He keeps talking past you. She says, you don't get it. I was hoping you were dead. I was disappointed when I came and you're walking around. You don't get it. The death. They're caught in that death stage. Well, as you know, they got a divorce, and he gets real hyper. They get jealous about the house. She feels like that's the only thing she has. She put all her soul in. He gets real envious and jealous and says no. His attorney, Danny DeVito, finds an obscure tenant-landlord act that says that in divorce you can stay in the same household together. I mean, you can share the property. So they have separate rooms in the same house, and it's warfare. And it's really the warfare inside the ego of the relationship, and they can't work it out. Well, after a while, you know, she goes in and tries to seduce Danny DeVito, kind of scene, anything to get this thing to break. Where we are now is Oliver and his attorney are in the office, and the attorney's saying, my God, this is scaring me. This is getting crazy, Oliver. This is getting crazy. Let's stop this. And Oliver says, I'm not going to stop. He's in his complex. Get rid of you. I'm going to do it my way. By God, I see it. And she got into gourmet cooking and became famous. And she's got like New York Times editors. She's previewing a new product at her home. And she didn't want him around, so she kind of hid the fact. And he found out about it. He's going to come in, and he's going to be a spoiler. And I want you to think about all you remember about Jung's conversation about prima materia in alchemy. Remember the great, you know, the primary mass. You got to get into this stuff. And what is prima materia? Well, it's often urine and feces. The alchemists use pretty primary prima materia. Can't grow a garden without manure at some kind of trite level. The alchemists believed that the magic happened with the objects of the outer physical world that were foul and repulsive. If we can get into it, it's really getting into our own shadow, we can begin to get transformation. So watch what happens in this alchemical guess who came to dinner. And we'll talk about, this is an image, I think, of the death marriage. Oh. Where is she in Paula Jung's model? Where is individuation for her? What stage is she in? And you let me make a suggestion. You'll see the stage each of them are in by the projections they make on the other person. Think of it that way as a hint. What does she see him to be? Is he an alien outsider, a patriarch, a youth hero lover, a partner within, an androgyne? Who is he in this sequence? Who does he become? The alien outsider, there's real regression in her own development. The projections are real primitive and ancient. And you could imagine she's probably not worked out her own inner, outer resolution of inner and outer incest. And she is an individual. More than he has, she's gotten farther in her development. She shows it in the film. There's some real poignant. Now let's think about Oliver. Like in the, where did I put that? Did it, these roll away? No, that's thank you. But that's the. If I don't find it right away, we'll just move on. It may be under all of this. Yeah, I bet you it's here. Here it is. I think. Yep. Where's his individuation? Where do you think he? What has he accomplished in all of this? Is he a dreamer or a mama's boy here? I think he acts like an entitled mama's boy. He's outraged. He's a screaming Oedipal child. Is he an addicted or impotent lover here? Pretty impotent. You could get a sense of his impotence, his rage, his childish impotence. He tries to show his... Where does a reaction formation line about his potency show up? Direct reference about his insecurity about his potency, I think. Yeah, you're not equipped. I mean, it was this kind of reaction formation against his own lack. Is he the detached manipulator or the denying innocent one, or both? He kind of comes as a trickster, the alchemical trickster. He's a detached manipulator, and he's also this denying innocent one. Okay, I don't want to create a scene here. I love this neighborhood too. But if you started it, the gloves are off. You know, I can't deny my innocence anymore. Well, but you know, you hate him for that. It's just outrageous. He a grandstander bully or a coward here? Hey. Yeah, he's the bully. Sadist, most of the time. He's a masochist, too, when he climbs inside the car and waits for her to come. Get on! That's the way stuff flips. When couples have fights, they'll flip into all of this stuff. Back and forth. High chair tyrant, boy, you see that. He's literally having a food fight. Well, I don't think I've ever even imagined going in and peeing on my parents' food. That's a great instinctual primitive desire to go and, you know, pee when you're that mad. I mean, you know, when you get literally pissed off. But I don't think I even had that conscious fantasy. And he's pretty tyranny and weakly. Not much individuation. It's the, you know, this couple. And, of course, what happens in the film. And, you know, the film is, I think, as much about the inner world as it is the outer world. Because it has this surreal quality. And that's a very alchemical scene, by the way. You know, people think Jung are nuts, don't know that they go to cinema and see this pure alchemy. The urine is a transformative substance, and what is he peeing on? Fish. Pistis, the symbol of the Christos and transformation within the mystical West. He's trying to get transformation moving, but he's doing it out of rage. His attitude towards the fish in the transformative urine is all wrong. It's arrogant and bullying and demanding and tyrannical. It's not humble and sad and full of sorrow and standing in front of and receiving. The attitude, what's wrong here is the attitude's wrong. And the attitude gets more and more. They can't affect the alchemical transformation. And, of course, what happens in the end, the violence exceeds what she does. It leads him to believe. She makes wonderful pâtés. And she leads him to believe that she's ground up his dog. I guess it was his dog into pâté and fed it. And he loved it. And then he says, "What is this?" And there's this scene where he says, "What is this?" And she looks, but she's trying to be gestures of this kind of obsequious peacemaking. And she leans forward and he asks, "It's wonderful, isn't it?" And he just goes psycho. She tries to lock him in the sauna and cook him to death. I mean, it's just crazy. In the last scenes, you both laugh and are horrified. They turn this place to a fortress. They wall up the doors, wall the thing shut. She hides. We start beating each other around. She hides in the attic and starts loosening this giant chandelier. She's like a bombardier pilot. She's waiting so that she can drop this chandelier on him and get rid of him. I mean, the death instinct gets higher and higher. Meanwhile, a maid returns and sees what happens. She gets panicked, calls the attorney, and they see this, hear it. They can't get in. They're running around trying to get a ladder. Oh, well, before it happens, they get in a fight, knocking each other around on the balustrade. He knocks her off the balustrade. She grabs the chandelier that she knows the nuts are loosened, and she's swinging. She's acrobat. There's another interesting kind of thing, but she's light. There's this symbol of her tricksterishness. She's an acrobat. And she's up there, and it's a mandala. The camera gets above and below it. It's a mandala, a symbol of the self. It's a mocking symbol in this film of the self. And again, trying to get the conjunctio, and she's swinging, and he gets into the hero mode. I'll save you. You know, I still love you. He's always denying that he really hates her, and I really like hate her. She says, no, don't be done. But he jumps anyway, and they're both on it. And the thing is, she says, Oliver, I loosened all the nuts. And they're running around, little dumpy Dana DeVito and this kind of German matronly maid woman, trying to get the ladder and get in to help them. And then it just drops. The final scene is they're lying in mangled glass inside this mandala chandelier. And to the end, he's still so denying, he goes and puts his hand on her shoulder. And with her last breath of consciousness, she takes it. Blows it off and they die, and then the camera pulls up and there's this dead couple inside this shattered candelabra mandala. They never individuated. They never got out of the first stage of individuation. They never got to that kind of alchemical, resurrecting, moistening sorrow. It never happened. And it was very anguishing. And people felt tricked and confused. You laughed and you felt afraid, ashamed of your laughter, and were disturbed about it. And at some level, it's also the death in your own relationships in the days that it just feels like you can't stand it anymore. And is there any individuating hope? Second image, I do believe couples inside and outside bring it off at rare moments. And I think John Huston in his last days finally got someplace through his pain. This film he wanted to do all his life. We talked about it. We'll see Angelica Huston in a very different light. It's the dead. James Joyce's this wonderful story about a party on Twelfth Night in Christmas holiday Dublin. And it's a wonder. I hope you can see it in the laser disc if you can't see it in the regular cinema. He wanted to even feel his soul in it. It's a very simple tale. This couple going and to give honor to a couple of his great aunts that he loved. And it's an interesting thing, a dinner party. Some people are too drunk. Some people talk too much. Some people are too intellectual. But there's poignance in it all. And Gabriel, the husband, stands up at the end and gives this lovely toast to his great aunts. That's just, Lee Spencer, it's endearing to the core of our being. He honors his family and all its weakness and all its joy. It's one of very poignant speech from the heart. And they're leaving now. It's the end of the party and they're helping the drunks out. All night they wanted to, this is this famous Irish tenor there that they tried to get to sing, and they never could get him to sing. And when it opens, Gabriel is helping the elderly and the drunk compassionately to their carriages to get them home in the cold Dublin night and pulling on his galoshes so that he and his wife can go back to their lodgings for the night. And that's where it opens. We'll see it to the end. It's a little bit of a long sequence, but it's worth every second of it. This was his film, I think. Yeah, he longed to do this. It was a very important project for him. That we all could be loved so well and give that kind of love in return. That's a very touching scene for me. And it holds alive, I think, in the archetypal world for us, that kind of inner conjunction and outer is possible. I don't even feel much like wanting to talk much about it. It's such a hole in its own piece. That clear tenor voice, soul of that, it's just wonderful. I think that's the goal of analysis and our suffering in the world, is we could get to some stage of non-reactivity. Gabriel got reactive and jealous a little. He's human. And he's still a male in this culture, and she can still confess openly and speak it into the air. He has to speak it in his thoughts still. But they're dear people. And they can stay non-reactive and present to themselves and the other. And he has some insight into his own death. This is really wonderful, separating from that incestuous attachment to his aunts and his mothers. Aware of his own humanness and fallibility. The preciousness of his spouse. The power and grace of Michael Fury that he never knew on the wild Irish night. He's just a wonderful people. Well, I think I want to do, we're right at four. I think I want to close with one last, this fits right now. All the other things I wanted to share, I could put in here the closing, I brought it with me, but it would just be more of the same. Another film, if you like this, a film that deals with the struggle and its transformation in the same film. Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage. The closing scenes, her dream at the end, and his response to it. The individuation of both of them through the film is very touching. It's another working at the same kind of ground. Another film I was going to show today about initiatory stuff is Blue Velvet. We were going to look at the opening scenes of Blue Velvet, but that'll be another time and another place. What I'd like to share now, I wanted to talk about innocence and individuation. And it's here. I don't have to talk much. That my sense analysis has been successful when we've been through an experience and we come out of it and we have more of a reverential and contemplative sense about our own archetypal depth. We have more genuine love and connection to our family and forgiveness for them and the real lovers in our life. This was in this piece. We have a more genuine connection to the earth. Somehow we recover a sense of the absolute preciousness of the earth. And I'm just not talking in kind of a trite environmental sense, but that the earth is a precious container of all psyche for us. It carries the cosmos. One of my favorite, it's an apocryphal story. I know Matt Fox, and I'm not running across his path the last 3 or 4 years to ask him. I've just heard the story through some mutual friends. I want to find out if it's true, but sometimes I'll be disappointed if it's not. But the story I heard, Matt Fox is kind of the living Roman Catholic version of Thomas Merton. And he's kind of the Pope's bad boy. He's writing a lot of, as a Dominican, stuff the church doesn't want to hear about masculine and feminine spirituality. And he's one of the folks that hopes the container can be cracked wide enough to not just completely die. This kind of Judeo-Christian container. But one of the stories I heard was that he went off to the Upper Rhineland. A woman named Hildegard of Bingen, who's becoming more and more popular as a woman mystic back in the 10th century and was an abbess, had a midlife crisis and a set of visions that she wrote about in a thing called The Illuminations, a series of drawings that Matt has found and recovered. He'd just brought these back. When one night there was a knock on his door and it was Rusty Schweikert, is the story I've told. And Schweikert, you may remember, was the astronaut in one of the early space shuttle missions that went out on the umbilical cord, and they wanted to see how long somebody could do some work in space without kind of going crazy. He was one of the suspended make-work things in space to see what kind of physiological reaction. And apparently, I've not heard all the story, but what I gather is that while he was doing the work, they tried to keep him very busy up there. He turned around and spied the earth at 100 miles up and went into an instant reverie, the absolute precious beauty of this green black veldt, this globe floating in this black veldt, and the blues and the aquas. He just went into reverie and began to weep. Was just taken with the transcendent beauty and preciousness of what we have here, this environment. And they were calling at him, and he didn't hear it. And he kept saying, you know, shuttle to Schweikert. Mother was calling Schweikert, you know, whatever. He didn't hear it. Came back out of his trance about 50 minutes. Reportedly finished the mission and left the space program, which has happened, I guess, to several astronauts. So they have a couple of the moon mission people had similar experiences. So numinous, they had to leave. And he started asking, who knows about this stuff? And somebody said, he became a searcher. And somebody said, probably you'll have better luck with Matt Fox than the Jungian analyst. So I'm going to give you Matt Fox's name. And showed up at Matt Fox's door and was describing his experience. And what I've heard is that Fox went back in the back room where he brought back some of these illumination plates of Hildegard of Bingen. And it was one of hers. It was kind of a vision she had of the earth. And he brought it out, and Schweikert started to cry again, and that's the same place I was at. You know? This conjunction about how could a woman have an inner vision 800 years before meeting an astronaut 800 years later that was touched and had a mystical reverie about the earth from the same. Who knows? And I'll be greatly disappointed if that story is not true, but it carries a sense of the preciousness of the earth. And the final thing for me about innocence and individuation, and if it work, if this process work, as a recovered sense to be an ability to notice and be moved by beauty, the aesthetic all around us, to start seeing more beauty in life than death and destruction, to see beauty. I loved it. Her face is still beautiful, though it's not the face Michael Fury once loved. He individuates and recovers new senses of the beauty of the beloved, the beauty of the outer object and the inner object. And I think alive and vital people are more open to beauty. It's said that later in his life, Jung was so sensitive to music, he could hardly bear to have anything played but a few selections because it moved him so much that he was just so open and his nerve endings were so raw to beauty. It almost overwhelmed him. He just couldn't take it all in. I hope that happens when we change. And I want to show just one last piece. This is we all have the favorite. It's my favorite film in the last 10 years. I've seen it 7 or 8 times, and I never grow tired of it. The strange film, Wim Wenders, still producing in Germany at the time he did this film. He's come over and done some American films now, but this is this film called Wings of Desire. You know, there is something profound about visual image and language. The older I get, when I was younger, I was interested in integrating body therapy and family therapy. The older I get, the more I work with just words, and the more I see words can do everything. Words, language carries image and body. And this film combines a poetic over-narrative text all the time with image. And it's an extraordinary story. It's just about this angel, these angels. It's interesting. This happened. It's a prophetic film. Made 2 or 3 years before the Berlin Wall literally fell. It was in Berlin, and it's about the wall. I think it's about the Berlin Wall, but it's about the wall between conscious and unconscious, between individuated, unindividuated, between free life and death, between the masculine and feminine. It's all of these walls. But this angel's up in his cathedral, and what these angels can do, they're melancholy, compassionate, poignant angels. They can't touch us, but what they do is they go around and listen, tune in to our head talk frequency all day. And they hear all the pain. A woman worrying about her dead son. A husband worrying about the abuse of his spouse the night before. An old Jewish man worrying about death in Auschwitz and saving the Zohar. There's all these voices. And what they do is the only way they can care about it, when people feel people in special distress, they just go and hover next to them and put their hands over their shoulders. And they're just a witness. And sometimes you notice people look a little funny. They feel the witnessing. It's almost, really, what's that the witnessing of in the model we've been using today? What do you think they feel? Who do they feel is animate and is... And do beautiful things? I mean, I want to feel. I want to stroke and smooth. It's real soothing. Wonderful. It's real deep. I mean, I had a deep kinesthetic feel. I want to do that. It's wonderful. It feels. It's wonderful. And I want you to think, where else have you seen movements like that around the face? Huh? Well, Kung Fu is that. Cheek to cheek. Have you seen any place else where you've seen a creature do that? Babies do that. You watch their hands often, fascinated with their face and stroking and or with the mother or father's face. And again, the regressive power. That's the same fetal. It's that wonderful, soothing sense of the body in elegant motion. Soothing, calming motion around the persona. Any other body stuff that you felt just watching? Well, good stuff. In the heart, kinesthetic stuff. Any other kind of body stuff?
Well, I felt something like fear. and my shoulder struggling. And I know the message is probably going to feel the same.
Very much so. Yeah. The tightening down. Kind of tightening. You can feel that. Incidentally, how do your legs feel? I notice I have a different feeling in my legs right now than I do in my hands when I think about that in their postures. That may have just been me. Legs feel tight. Posture's close. And a little aggression in it. I mean, you feel that kind of loaded tension. The model. Ego, where's ego, where's self, and where's the disturbance? Where's ego? Here, just think a little bit. Where would you think ego was here? Thinking of that model. Where would we locate? Possibly. I think ego might be farther away than that. I think it's him. I mean, where I located, it's him. And where is he? He's behind a what?
One-way
mirror. That good, safe place for ego to always want to be, behind a one-way mirror. You get this stuff, it's amazing. We all want to watch the unconscious at a safe, protected distance. We don't want to get out in it. Sure. What does ego... Does ego go in and bring Christina? Sends a servant. Sends the shadow figure. Says, psst, Antonio wants to see, you know, in his compartment, in a one-way mirror. Whenever I'm dealing with unconscious, I want it to come in on my grounds. I don't want to have to go see the... I don't want it to jump off the cliff. It's come on the spaceship and we'll have a talk. You know, it's a lot safer in here. I don't want to get out there where I'm feeling all this tension exposed in this wide open room. Oh, I think so.
Looking at first through the mirror.
But that's, see, and I want, again, this Lacanian sense of who's really looking and spying on who. I mean, you see the constant reference to mirrors and mirrored images and stepping through mirrors and one way. There's all of that mirroring thing that goes on. Who? Where's reality and where's the mirror? It gets real interesting. But where's ego? Where is the self? A good sense of where the ego is, protected in a safe place and in demanding and wanting things to adapt and be reasonable. He goes, let's be reasonable about this. You be cooperative with my goals, and let's just get it done. Where's the self? A little dicier question. I think it has to be so fanciful a little bit about where the self might be.
Is he in the opera?
I think the opera, the opus itself, the alchemical opus, the actual opera itself, the Carmen, I think really is the self in the full sense. He's an alchemist. If you've ever done theater, if you've ever written poems, if you've ever written a play, if you've ever written a book, if you've ever written an article, if your self lays it, it possesses us. I mean, I always have got two of the articles hanging in my computer, but they're really hanging in my psyche, and I'm trying to get the self. I mean, that we all have that. I think that's true. And who are the representatives of that deeper self? I think that's wonderful. Who might be some representatives that provide a potential connection to that self? I think one of them's even named with a self name, if you think about it. Christiana. The Christ. Christos. I mean, the root of her word is the self. I mean, literally, the Christos, the older woman, the older mediatrix. I think she really is a medium to the self, and he knows it. He needs her cooperation as an anima figure if the self is ever going to fully constellate. He knows the wiser. I think in a lot of ways we're looking at his unconscious. We're looking at aspects of his own, trying to differentiate the feminine. And I think Christina carries part of it for him, and the young woman carries part, and he's got to figure out a conjunctio. It's as much an inner as it is an outer. He's got to figure out how to get those two to cooperate. His older Eros and his younger Eros. And what does Christina also carry in terms of our theme before lunch? Christina is, I think, carries also some mother, unfinished mother Eros and incest issues. It's all being worked out here. And he wants to try and differentiate. And I think that Carmen, with the play and this thing, I'll show us, if we get time later on today, there's this wonderful, the famous prison scene in the opera when they come to arrest Carmen. It's danced flamingo, and these two women go at each other across the, they're antagonistic, and these women do all this flamingo. And it's one of the, it's just stunning. I every time I see it, I love it more. And if we get a chance, flamingo guitars wailing in the back, and macho men stamp on the floor and macho women stamping back. And Spanish and all, it's kind of dark, wonderful passion. Let's go a little deeper now. We touched the outer theme. Let's look at this. Oh, I thought I had it here. I wanted to show the grifters. Closing scene. God, it's a really interesting film. I think it takes place all in the unconscious. We got Ron, who is a shady card trickster and gambler, and his estranged mother, Lily, who works for the mob and hustles money between tracks. And Myra, his lover, who's hot on the make and wants Ron to go to the top in the shadow underworld. And the film just gets darker and greasier as it goes on. It's one of those films that just sticks. It never lets up. And it ends in the darkest, greasiest final scene probably any film in the last 10 years. Disgusting. People had visceral responses. I was joking over lunch up until about 5 or 6 years ago. Nothing got across the Pierce County line, but Burt Reynolds and Raquel Welch was about the only thing that they'd show in Pierce County. And stuff is... The grifters got in, but it had a Tacoma response. You just could hear this. People were going, yuck, and they were mad, and they were walking. I'm going to show you this enraging the scene, this an outrageous closing scene. We'll talk about the model before lunch. They are in Ron's apartment, Ron and Lily are having just a friendly family conversation here. Kind of conversation that every normal American family has on a quiet afternoon. How you feel? Where is it in your body? How you feel in response? That's a real... That's now. That's a real recent director. Incidentally, it's one of the new directors in Martin Scorsese's production company. Scorsese produced this. Stephen Frears directed. So, artists grabbing stuff out of the objective and putting it back at us. How you feel? Where's your body with? Yeah, the neck. Real. We'll talk about that neck in a minute. That neck's a real interesting thing. Where's ego? If you can find it. I don't know. Is there any ego here? Any place? Ego or conscious capacity at all as you look around inside that frame, that film frame. Huh? Well, money being a symbol in our culture for what? At its most base psychological level. Power. Well, even deeper than that, it's really a symbol for what? Energy, eros again. It is really a symbol for eros. It's our cipher for the gods. I mean, that's why we lust after so much, but we hope it's that divine nectar. So it's there, but it's not humanized in any form. It's real psychoid that there's no personal identity or conscious or human identity with that money. It's pretty raw. It's psychoid energy. Is there any human consciousness anywhere here? People that are acting, is there any ethical, self-reflexive, self-aware, courageous consciousness that you saw any place there? Most where it showed up is, Lily, what are you doing? I'm your mother. You're my mother. Of course you're my mother. I mean, you know. I think that is the only place where it shows up is the panic. How old does he feel when you're my mother? Of course you're my mother. You're my mother. How old is he? Huh? Yeah, or even younger. You feel the rapid regression as he's closed on the space. I mean, B.B. talks about Hitchcock's negative mother complex. Well, this is somebody's negative mother complex is floating around here. Somebody, and it, you see consciousness slip out of him. Of course, you're my mother. I do anything. So there's very little ego. Where's the self? Our soul, possibility for transformation. Where is the self here? If you can't find much of the ego, can we find much of the self anywhere in this frame? pretty hard to find the self. Did you see any place where the self was?
Oh, her grief.
Her grief.
His terror.
His terror in face of that. And I think even the blood, the spilt blood, is the sacrificed wound. You feel terrible about the wound. It's horrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's a mythic wound. Convulsing. He's convulsing and she's convulsing, and you don't even, the soundtrack there, you don't know whether that gurgling sound is her sobs or his blood in his throat. It's both in the throat. It's visceral. The self, the horror of the self is there.
I was distracted by the way she was bent over. It looked like a man, making love.
A raping, it was almost like a raping motion. The incestuous rape that had just occurred. Something pitiful about that, isn't it? Just poignant and pitiful. Yeah. Pitiful. I feel sad about that somehow. Just the pity that there's so little consciousness in this human being and in the psyche. There's so little grace. There's so little light. What you develop the pity for is the incest wound that she's suffering for. That's unconscious. It's a transgenerational wound that is going to go on and on. And you're how split off she is from her wholeness, and the negative phallus, the bad phallus, and the bad breast so cut off. It only comes out in these kind of violent. And you do have a character. With all the characters, actually, Myra's the one that I felt least identified with by the end of the film. But there's some poignant. No, what do you think the director's saying? You think the director is concerned about the state of the cult, the psychological and spiritual state of our culture right now? And our ability to creatively resolve these incest wounds and these enmeshment wounds and the shadow that's in all of us out of this pain, and our seeming growing inability to look at the con trickster in ourselves and the shadow darkness? And I think this film's a very poignant and despairing note and very concerned. It's a cinematic essay on the state of the psychological state of our culture. Dorothy didn't wake up in Kansas in this film. Okay, we all want to wake up in Kansas, and that will be okay. We don't want to believe that evil has any perduring quality. I'm sorry.
The way that many writers have taken them and lightened them up. And yet, if you give a child a chance to read several different versions of the tale, the child inevitably picks the original, which is sometimes more horrible. I think it's somehow not the passage ending thing. It isn't true. But I haven't seen it really.
Which is the power of a film like this, and I think its ethical power is, as much as we're horrified about it, it does provoke powerful energy, and it lingers, and it gnaws, and it ethically eats at us in our own isolation and encapsulation, and I think hopefully useful ways. Comment this morning about we don't have any, to have an experience of being open like this, if it's genuinely a spiritual experience and these are cathedrals, we no longer have priests and priestess, functional people that can help, in a community that sacramentally can help us live with the ambivalence of evil with some sense of hope. And let's face it, I don't know why you all are interested in Jungian psychology, but I'm interested because Carl Jung provided me a way in this culture at a time of real vulnerability in my life to deal with the reality of evil and have some sense that there might be some prospective hope and meaning through living with the ambivalence of evil. That's what fascinates me about Jungian psychotherapy. And it's not going to be wrapped up, but that there might still be some meaningful progression through evil. I may not, Jung's big crisis with the church was that Jung hated the privatio boni argument, that evil is simply but the absence of good. There's a lot more here than just the absence of good. We identify with this woman. The evil's much darker and stickier, and the sacrifice and the death here is much more ambivalent and hard and complex than that. It's much more than just evil here is much more than the absence of good. It's much more than that. And
what I was getting out of it was living on the edge. Living right on the edge. He was there. This was an ultimate game. I mean, I never thought of moving. And I'm going to. I mean, I could just see him fight the ultimate. Everything he probably had done previous wasn't as exciting as what was going on.
Some living on the edge. Some of us always want mommy all to ourselves or daddy all to ourselves. Some deep that kind of dark, frustrated wish lives forever. And for the absolute caring and caressing parent we wished we'd had that we never had, but we want to live back on that edge again. If we ever had the chance, we'd want to live back on that edge again. We want to be absolutely one with him in the deepest spiritual and psychological. We all yearn for that. And that's, you know, some people push that to the edge in unhealthy ways. Angelica Houston?
Uh-huh. Now, this is a play that what she said. She said this was the most difficult role that she ever had to play. And it was difficult for her to be this person because she was so far removed from this kind of a character. However, she was going through a really corrupt time in her life. Perhaps one of it was raising up the Japanese, and I'm not sure. But she didn't say that. But it was a really hard time, and she said that's what she would do. She would just get her mood. She was just kind of dead. And she looked dead and alive, and just put that mask on and go about it. But I was going to ask you, he, even though he wanted to be away from his mother in his own way, though, was like a small time,
It's collusion. That's well, sure. We both want to individuate, and the collusion is, but I don't really want to get conscious. This crazy known is a lot safer than the uncrazy, potentially uncrazy unknown. Let's keep this going. It always takes co-participants to keep any kind of painful thing going, and it's hard for us to give up our primary parent and become adults. It's a terrible, terrible pain. We don't want to give it up. We don't give the dream up. So we collude to not give it up. People go in analysis, and it's constant slipping into collusion again. I don't want to stay conscious. It's too painful. I don't want to do this anymore. I take it back. I'd rather go back to my old unconscious state. It's better and more endurable than this. I don't want to take the risk. It's interesting, too. This is unfair, but they're public figures. I have been interested. A lot of you ever had this, wondered about John Houston and Angelica Houston? John Houston played in Chinatown, where he was an ancestor. She's an ancestor here. It's always been, and she starred in his last film, the film he wanted to, which I want to show today, which we may not get to, the closing scene in the bed. And much different view of her. And I think a view of her own father's hope for a more purified anima and a more purified spirit state that he'd yearned for all his life. He'd always wanted to do the dead, never got the money or the backing of the right place. And his last film before his death, he did finally got it on the screen.
Right.
Well,
that is the story of
your
wife
in
some ways.
You wonder.
I mean, I don't know her, but I know some people involved. And that is, it is very close to her. What she has lived.
Oh, yeah.
This movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you can't help. I can't. I have that gossipy, voyeuristic thought when I watch her, and I think. I mean, they're both people involved in this mirroring industry, and they've been involved in common projects, and they've had these incesting roles. He carried his role off with such a ruthless sense of authority, and she carried her role off with such a sense of... I mean, you don't know. You know where art becomes life. But I couldn't help having that voyeuristic thought when I watched the film. And it's a multiple levels... And, of course, I have those thoughts as a way to avoid thinking about my own ancestry. I mean, it's always a way to kind of keep it at a distance, you know? My attraction to this and my horror of it. We're going to go one step further. Well, we're really... Now, this... Presumably, this looks about male incest, but this is an Italian director, a woman. This is a very complex double sequence you're going to see. It's very hard to see. I just say stay alert. Be provoked. Try not to go to sleep at this. It's hard. the context of the film, The Night Porter, Dick Bogart plays a former Nazi SS camp worker. And it's post-war, and he's got a hidden identity, and he's got a job as the night porter in this hotel. And lives in kind of a depressed daily expectation of his exposure, I think. And some kind of confessional sense that maybe it's necessary. You get a sense that he knows an enormous crime against his own humanity has been committed. And then things are going all right, and their former collaborators, they have a network and have these conspiratorial meetings, and they have to figure ways to do people in that may expose them. Constant paranoia in the film. The constant paranoid vigilance of what? Ego or self, do you think, when you hear that? Who's being vigilant all the time? Ego's being vigilant against being flooded by the dark unconscious. And the ego's often this cabal of these men meeting to control and a couple women. As the film develops, a woman checks in, and to his horror, it's the one inmate that he had a strangely sadomasochistic but very erotic encounter with when she was an inmate. And she recognizes him, and he recognizes her, and they co-collude to re-enter that incestuous, dark relationship, that violative relationship. The scene we're seeing is he's talking to an older woman who had been in a camp with him. She'd been an SS officer, been one of the women, SS-affiliated women in this. And we'll just open with that scene. It's him talking to her and confessing a memory in this relationship. And then we'll watch the memory. And it's hard, but I think it's important. I think it's important a woman's putting it on the screen for us. I think we'll get a different feeling about this than we did from Stephen Frears.
How's your body feel about that?
Does a woman auteur enter your body any differently than a male auteur does? Huh? Woman directed this, yeah. Italian. Very controversial. Both men and feminists were split about this film. There was a tremendous debate. Lots of ink was spilled on this film. Lots of ink. And hurt and heart. And it was a horrifying. People were very disturbed. Which indicates it's a good film. I know it's not a good film as it disturbs the culture and psyche. Something's going on. Where's ego? Such as it is. Again, you know. Where is the ego here? Any places where there's any ego functioning in terms of an individuated sense? And how did you see, how would you perceive her ego function? What kind of qualities? So there's kind of a confessional, confrontational quality to her. She's being analytic and honest. So maybe some function there. What a crazy thing to do. Any other place where you saw any kind of consciousness? What's that? Well, I guess that could be kind of a negative consciousness. There's this, she's talking about the military, talking about the SS soldier sitting inside the uniform, the military qual. Of course, it's a really crazy psychoid. I mean, that was the whole Nazi. And we'll talk a little bit about that, about why a woman in the 70s would want to put a film with all that kind of frame on, what that's all about. But, you know, there's some structure, negative kind of organizing structure, but it's there. Any other place? You saw any? Oh, Charlotte's looking, the horror of his literal, he is literalizing something that was more metaphoric for her. And his absolute inability to make a differentiation. Her horror. Yeah, crying and shocked. She just turned away. It's not the way she wanted to deal with her torments. And any consciousness in his sorrow at all. He weeps at the table. And I love her. Was there any shadow of authenticity, sliver of authenticity in those tears for you? It's there. It's, you don't trust it fully, but it's not differentiated. But there's a little. Where's the self? Such as it is again. Where's the self here? Where's any hope for transformative possibility or individuation? Where is it anyway? So some possibility of the connection as twisted and sadomasochistic, if it could be lived through and individuated, it might still be redemptive. They still stay attached. Possibility. This film ends tragically, and the film tells us they, in the physical world, they both die. As a consequence of them choosing to collude in this sadomasochistic affair again, it ends in their physical and symbolic death. Any other place where you saw any kind of self, statements about self? What about the biblical story? How do we amplify that story of Solomon? You know, what is that all about? What is that story all in regard to? Why is that John the Baptist part of the mystical tradition of the Judeo-Christian West? It's a very important. What is the consciousness? Yeah, and I think you're right. What is the symbol of consciousness in that story? And how does that story remind us? I mean, what in the story reminds us? What I'm saying, the actual Salome story, the John the Baptist Salome story, what is the parable want to teach us? Why is the story important? How are we being kind of psychologically and spiritually instructed by that story inside that mystical corpus about the arrival of the Christ? And how does that story, why is that story important? Well, there's a sacrifice, and what sacrifice? The head's cut off. The head's cut off. Yeah, you may have read Jung in his book on psychological types. He talks about Origen and Tertullian, and one of them decides to give up being intellectual and decides to live in the world of feeling, and he called it sacrificium intellectus, the sacrifice of intellect, the only way he could find God. The other decided to castrate himself. Even psychological types, Jung uses these two people as two men of different types, the sacrificium phalli, the sacrifice of the body or the phallus. And Jung's implying that some people live too much in their head and some people live too much in their body, and you need to know how to sacrifice that over-dominant reliance to get soul. You got to cut it off. So there might be some of that about an overly intellectual religion having to cut the head off of stuff to get at things. There might be some of that in the story. Anything else when you think about, how do you amplify that story? What are the qualities? Is jealousy in there, and envy and sadism? And who's the kingpin in that story? Yeah. Who's Papa? Who's the father? Who's Salome's father? Remember? Herod. And what's Herod's key role? What does Herod do? What's Herod's craziness? He tries to kill all the infants. He tries to kill the self. He tries to kill innocence. To try to save himself. To prop up a false ego. So I think it early on sets up a theme about an inflation that gets so crazy, an incestuous, kind of incestuous dark inflation that doesn't moderate, individuate, and tries to kill the self and kill the infant and kill the vulnerable. Do you think Liliella Caravani is talking about that potential still in our culture in showing this to us? Where's the incest here? That's right, in the story. And in this, where's another level of incest in this film vignette? He's fatherly and she's young, and then what's another level of that? It's all there. The older woman and him. And at all three levels, there's quite a bit of unconsciousness and dark manipulation if you look at it. She eventually, this woman's part of the Kabbalah, turns him in, and did you hear their phrase for termination? Did you hear the typical Nazi, to file away? We should file her away. We should file her away. This woman's part of the group that makes the decision to file him away because he's so out of control. Mm-hmm. He's starting to, you know, there's possibly by trying to individuate through the sadomasochistic thing and get through the pain and get more conscious, it gets too threatening to Herod and the organized. I think Liliana Caravana is talking about how hard it is at the personal level, the family level, and the societal or collective level to get conscious to the incestuous, the pull to incestuous unconsciousness and merger and the outrage that always results if we are not conscious human beings of our own wound and our own pain and willing to step out of those frames. And if we don't do it, whole cultures go crazy, which happened in Nazi Germany. Oh, Jung just said they went in a collective trance, and the dark great mother and great father, the split off bad penis and the bad breast, to use the kind of language today, seized them. They went into a trance for 5 years and committed horrible projective crimes. Killed 13 million innocent human beings as a way to get evil, to project it, to never finish projective identification on a global scale, to get rid of evil and to wash their hands of it. And it didn't work. They kept trying to cut the head off of the darkness, and it never worked. I think Liliana Caravani was trying to talk a film that was operating at all these levels, and she hyper-excited everybody because she opened up so much of the mystery and the darkness about this, and was more than we could bear. We didn't want to bear it. And Liliana Caravana, as a courageous auteur, was saying, you must bear it. We can't risk not bearing it. 30 years after this thing, and we're now talking like it didn't really happen. You know, and people were starting to write stuff. That was the beginning of that literature. Said the Holocaust was a myth. It was 30 years after. People wanted to go to sleep. That's too horrifying. We can't look at the consequences of an incested unconsciousness and people that don't individually. All that stuff about the motherland and the fatherland, Mutter and Vaterland. It was an incestuous attraction to unindividuated thinking and ideas. And I am so horrified that 100, you know, I don't want to get political, but the incestuous stuff, 150,000 relatively innocent human beings were slaughtered, and there's been no grief about this. They used my tax money. These were cannon fodder Iraqi peasants, apparently, who these were. These weren't even the National Guard that he'd come up. These were peasants thrown up as cannon fodder, and we dropped these gas bombs on them for 30 days, the most high-tech. And there's been not a bit of grief, collective grief and sorrow in our culture about the death. But absolutely, you can't even get exact figures. Some people are... They got in there quickly, cleaned it up, and I have some people say it may be as high as 250,000.
Mass grave.
Liliana Caravani's film talks to us now. I mean, it's the pressure to be unconscious. And I was horrified when, you know, it's the first time in my life that I had the experience. My parents had the experience of a society going to war in 24 hours after Pearl Harbor. I never had that. And Vietnam was a long, slow death. It never was a declared war. It was just a nightmare that just got worse. And they never had a... I can't remember where Vietnam ever began in my consciousness. We remember when it started to end, when Richard Nixon left the White House in disgrace and climbed in a helicopter. You had a feeling of the ending of things. It was always there in my generation. I'd never gone to war in 24 hours. So that thing happened. I was both horrified, but driving home, I had a spontaneous fantasy of being a pilot in one of those bombers in a night sky. It, the regressive pull of participating in that, and the kind of Votonic warrior in me. Even deeper grief. And I think I was a pilot, and knowing what they knew and climbing the planes and knew I made a decision to do it anyway, that would be very hard to live with. Like the pilots that flew the bombers over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they had terrible psychosomatic disorders for decades after that. You can't carry that kind of thing. Ego can't carry that kind of mass destruction in its belly and hold it. And I think Liliana Caravani would say there's some real incestuous darkness and unconsciousness in a culture that would try to project its shadow out into the Middle East and think you can gas bomb it, and now Vietnam's over and we're purged. It was done in the name of purging the last atrocity. I mean, that was what it was. We got a double atrocity to purge now. We're going to be grieving. Our children are going to grieve about this. Well, that's the power of film. Film implicates us personally. It implicates us familially, and it implicates us culturally, which is, when you're in analysis, I think we're challenged at all. Again, I think if somebody finishes analysis, they're they're not more individuated and calm in themselves. They're not more loving and intentional with their real families and their loved relationships. And they don't have more of a sense of compassion for the earth and a sense of kind of a planetary compassion and a grounded hope. It hasn't worked yet. The process hasn't finished. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back. I want to put up a... What I want to do is we're into it. We'll talk about male and female. And then I'll try to slide in the peace and the individuation and innocence thing in the tail end. But we're going to look at a couple of vignettes about masculine and feminine when we come back. And then a couple of pieces about innocence, and we'll be at the end of the day. Don't look at the screen. I've got to go to the bathroom first. When I come back, I've got to send him an image. I think this is dangerous and uncertain and potentially exploitative ground for any of us to talk about with any authority. The greatest, most dangerous, and I think the issue that has the most potential we all know in our culture right now, and Jung was centrally involved in it for his time, is this whole issue about masculine and feminine. Probably the two most important opposites we experience in this worldly existence. And all of our confusion about how much is it gender-based and how much is it archetypally based, how much ravage has there been, how much exploitation and rape, how much mutilation, what have we done to each other in the name of being masculine and feminist, our greatest ongoing pain. And increasingly, I'm suspicious of anybody that talks authoritatively about it or acts like they figured it out. I think we're going to suffer to the end. And we all know that it's terribly important. The older I get, I know there is something that feels something distinctively different about the masculine and the feminine, that both seem to be honorable and important distinctions. And somehow some of that is objectively other from me as a man, and some of it I psychologically have both aspects in my soul. And something about my relationship with one woman that I hope lasts a lifetime has been a deeply teaching process. It's a kind of mutual instruction and suffering through. I also believe that it does not have to be with biologically opposite folks. It can happen in homosexual as well as heterosexual relationships. But it's something about the projected other and learning about that. And it seems to be intensely important that we all need that experience in this world if we can bring it off. Or to be conscious about its absence and suffer it through. I do believe there's dedicated monks and vowed folks that have individuated, but they somehow have worked with the other in creative ways that didn't work. So I'm not an authority here, and I just want to put film up, and I just want us to be provoked by Hollywood's images. I've had some ideas about it recently that I want to share. I'm going to share a couple of the traditional, the most recent Jungian perspectives that seem provocative to me about it. And then I want to share one of my perspectives and look at a couple of film vignettes, and I'm not saying anything authority, just want to be a little, hopefully helpful with some frames and open it up for you all to kind of respond. And I do believe that masculine and feminine is related to this primal wound. We both share the primal wound, but we may respond to it differently. And I'm interested in how the difference to that wound may be for men and women and where the same is. I think as therapists, that's a big issue for us. I think we are wounded by that other. And I love the feminists returning to Freud and now talking about the bad breast and the bad phallus. And I think that happens to both of us, male and female. First, you look at the work of Flo Wiedermann and Polly Eisendrath, Jung, their attempt, you know, Jung's original hypothesis about anima and animus, which we all know now is inadequate. The biggest critique I hear right now of the classical Jungian perspective, I get upset with folks whipping Jung's, you know, stuff he wrote in the 20s and 30s is not being relevant now. I think Jung, as a man in the 20s and 30s, had some kind of interesting new vision. Still caught in patriarchy. And one of the obviously patriarchal ideas is that there's some kind of equal balance and there's these list of criteria. It's a little too male and left-brained. It adds up too easy and too quick. But it's an interesting notion, that classical notion that each of us have 50% masculine and feminine in us, that half of a man's identity is masculine and it's in the anima, and he has to mediate and get conscious to that to be whole, and half a woman's unconscious is the animus and she has to mediate that and get whole. It's an interesting notion. Tony Wolf took that idea. It's interesting. It's a woman, I think, provoked the anima awareness in Jung anyway. And she later wrote her kind of classical expansions of that Jungian idea. Kind of got into virgin and mediatrix and why is a woman kinds of her kind of quaternal vision of the differentiated feminine. And the most recent, really, Flo and Polly have tried to look at the new, I think, information from feminism. Polly's been very informed of Flo by feminist theory and writing, their own analytic practice. Polly practices. I think she's coming, isn't she? It didn't happen? Oh, it's a shame. She's a really good presenter, and she practices marriage and family therapy in an analytic style, and so I'm obviously interested in that. But I just quickly step through. Their model comes across as a little bit of a stage model to me, but they kind of talk about, they've taken Toni Wolff and stretched her out and added some new information about from feminist theory and research. But they now want to think about at least a five-part image of how a woman may experience this inner masculine in her life, kind of a sense of developmentally how this might flow across the life cycle. Is woman experiencing the animus first as alien outsider, as this absolutely strange psychoid figure that she has no kind of, it's probably terrifying or enraging. And it comes up in her unconscious. It comes up, I think it probably, they both say it comes up both in her unconscious and in her projected relationships. I mean, it shows up both. That's the way psyche comes for us. It comes in our dreams and it comes in our real world daily firing of our complexes. The alien other. And if a woman individuates and sits with that complex and her reactivity and her fear, the next stage may experience something about the animus as patriarch. The power of the wise father and maybe the controlling father. And I imagine you can sense a kind of a lightness and darkness to both of these, or all of these categories. The animus then is youth, hero, is lover, mediated in unconscious images probably of Apollo and Zeus and Dionysius, and successful outer world achievement and feeling that energy in her own sense of becoming an attorney, a lawyer, a university professor. Then, at a deeper level, that the animus is just not these outsiders, or just not these qualities of wisdom and control, or just not this quester and lover and accomplisher, but there's some kind of sense of psychic partnership, that this other is really a partner within and without. And then ultimately, this image of kind of the androgyne, that the masculine and feminine are quietly within my psyche and within my relationships in a whole and balanced way. And when I read them, what occurs to me when I try to imagine what they're talking about here is I see my grandparents and a lot of old folks that have been with each other across 40, 50 years. I remember my grandparents, I used to go visit them down on their 178-acre farm in central Kansas. That was the big highlight of my year. I was a city kid, but for 2 months I got to go farm. I was the ninth grandchild and the first male, and I was always a favorite of my granddad's. He was one of the guys that I bootlegged some mail time with because my dad was gone. And being down there on the farm and sleeping in that old 120-year-old, the original homestead house, that old bedroom, and I'd sleep in the same bed with them, and they both snored, and being on that kind of that sea of snoring, I'd have a lot of fondness. But being with them, and at dusk they'd take a little walk. And I'd seen, my granddad liked to go every night, and he'd go to each of the quarters, the 80-acre quarters, and he'd take up the earth, and he'd just feel it for the moisture content. But it was also, it looked very prayerful to me. It was a way he kind of put his feet. And I remember once he took me, I put my little hands, put that little dirt in my hands, wrapped around. He said, "That's as close to God you'll ever get. You know, just had you feel it. Can you feel it?" Well, those are important things, that kind of earthy. I'm real touched by Jung's always wanting to get back out among the peasants in the earth and close to where it grew, and I understand that. But at twilight, I'd see the two of them walking, and over age, my granddad's frame got softer, and my grandmother's frame got a little more angle to it. And at twilight, when they were out west walking that 80, I couldn't tell who the male was and who the female was and who grandma was and who grandpa was. And maybe that's the androgyne, you know, there's some kind of external image I had of the androgynous possibilities of life. And, you know, my granddad, from what I understand, when he was in his 30s, he was a terrifying rip. But when I got to know him, he was something softer. My grandmother was, I understand, pretty depressive and hysterical from my mother's descriptions, but she was a very soulful Sophia woman by the time I knew her. Something, it is possible to individuate. Something about that. So this, I want to just put these images up. This is some analysts, women that are processing, and I thought it's really important to at least get their images. One of the most recent images I know of in the literature right now, Bob Moore, who's part of the Michael Mead, Robert Bly, Jim Hillman, Quaternio that's going around doing men's stuff. Bob's a pastoral psychologist and union analyst of the Chicago Institute. Came out with, co-authored a book, a guy named Gillette, on, well, let's see, the four categories they've got here.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.